Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport. Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined again by a very special guest, Steve Govett. Of too many titles to list here, I'm going to start by saying that you are a member of the Board of World Lacrosse because you're wearing a World Lacrosse shirt. You are, what, founder president of TFL?
I'm one of a group of a few guys that are very interested in kind of establishing lacrosse and collectibles and having a bunch of fun doing it. So just one of many, but yeah. It's fun.
And then let's call it like a longtime industry veteran of the National Lacrosse League, San Diego Seals, Colorado Mammoth, Washington Power, and the league itself. What'd I miss? Radford alum? I think that's an important
Radford
detail.
Radford alum.
Salmon Belly?
Team Canada?
Yeah, Team Canada.
I never played for the Salmon Bellies. I didn't
Who'd you play for?
Salmon Bellies. I played for the Coquitlam Adnacks in senior, and I played for the Burnaby Lakers. And so I did all that, but yeah, some Team Canada, some, yeah, Vail. I played in Vail once or twice.
There you
Does
go.
That count?
I don't know that that rises above the line. We love the Vail guys, so sure. But most recently published author, and that's why we're joined by you today.
I got a bit of a bug to do this. The one we're going to talk about today is the first book.
Yep.
The second book is amazingly has nothing to do with lacrosse. It's more about golf.
Okay.
And it's about an amazing human that I know who's 87 years old and has shot at or below his age more than 1,650 times.
Oh my God.
He is the Guinness World Record holder for shooting his age at or below, and literally has a stack of 1,700 scorecards.
That's awesome.
And so, you know, he's 87 and still he's just an amazing human. Montreal guy. He comes to San Diego in the winter time, and he's just an amazing human. But so that's the second book, and then just started yesterday the third book.
Oh no,
second book in the series that we're going to talk about here. But the first book's called Whistle Ready.
Yeah,
and Whistle Ready is about it's about your first time stepping up to the plate as a coach. And the book is not lacrosse kind of specific. It's not a playbook. It's not a drill manual. It's not a rule book. It's not any of that. It's kind of a systems book about, you know, I stepped up to coach. It's called Whistle Ready. You agreed to coach. Now what? And
yeah.
There's so many dads out there. There's so many young people out there that start their coaching journey and then realize, yeah, this sounds like a really good idea, or they're not going to have a team if I don't step up and help, or somehow they get involved in coaching and have absolutely no clue what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. So
and not realizing that it's not about running drills on the field.
I want to go through the book and I have a few questions that I want to steer the conversation with, but one of the first topics that is always so useful whenever you have a conversation like this is why. And in this case specifically, why did you do it? And one of the things that stands out, I love dedications because I think that they're a window into the soul of the book itself as well as the author's mindset. And in the dedication you wrote, for my dad Ron and my brother Dan, I don't coach if not for them. Why?
Yeah, so I came from a family that was quite sports oriented. I don't think you can get as ingrained in this as I can. But my dad grew up, you know, a hockey player wearing, you know, in Canada, the old Eaton's catalogs as shin pads, right? Like they wrapped the shin pad around, and you know, he was an older dad with me, and then I had an older brother who's 20 years older than I am. And so kind of my journey with those two people in sports was, you know, my brother was a hockey goalie older than me, and I got to play with him every once in a while. But he had a son that's about 10 years younger than me And so when the son was like 6, 8, starting his hockey journey, my brother said, "Do you want to come out and coach?" And I was 16 or 17 at the time. And it was my first kind of experience on the ice with him. And, you know, it was pretty, I would say it was a moment for me that was a bit defining, like being involved in coaching and wrangling cats with kids, and, you know, that I loved it. And my dad was a baseball coach for my brother's team when he was a kid. And he not only did he coach the team, but all of a sudden he's like building a ballpark right in our hometown. And so the story of you get involved in coaching, but all of a sudden you're building clubs and you're building teams and you're part of an ecosystem. So when he signed up to coach a baseball team, I'm sure he didn't realize he was going to be building a ballpark, you know, for a little league ballpark. And, you know, my brother was a part of that process. So those two guys were a significant influence, because if not for those two, I don't start down a coaching journey. And again, I had a lot of experience before, you know, at 35, 36, I'd become a dad. And then ultimately at 40, I start coaching those kids. Right. And so I had 20 years of coaching experience to kind of understand that before I coach my kids. But there are a lot of dads, a lot of moms that step up, put their hand up and say, "I want to coach," or "I'm going to coach," or "I have to coach," or they don't have a team. And so they step into it and going, and they get overwhelmed. They don't know what's going on. And, you know, they start reading all these books about, you know, lacrosse for dummies. Like,
right.
Okay, I need drills. I need this and that. But they lose their way in the process of communicating with parents and communicating with the league and other coaches and scheduling and all these things that go with it, that they didn't know they signed up for.
So that's a nice segue into the second question, which is, so you just established, and our introduction of you established, like, you are very ill-equipped to know what it feels like to not know how to coach on two bases. Number one, you just explained how familiar you were with coaching at a young age. And number two, you were a professional lacrosse player. Like, your level of expertise when it comes to lacrosse, you know, is in the 99.99th percentile. But I've noticed in the foreword that Brett Frued, the commissioner of the NLL, referenced the fact that he has coached many sports. And I feel like that's an interesting avenue into the question to you, which is, what experience did you have coaching your kids' sports that you were unfamiliar with, and how did that inform your perspective on this topic? Basically, how, because I think your point is the right one, and it's what this book isolates. Don't lose the forest for the trees. Everybody thinks that subject matter expertise in the sport is the primary thing you need, and it is not. It is the secondary thing you need. The primary thing you need is, and we'll get to this in greater detail in a second here, understanding systems structure and navigating those. But I'm curious as to your experience of removing that secondary layer of knowledge and what you experienced entering into those spaces, because at the very least you had this primary area of knowledge and how to navigate the systems of coaching gymnastics or basketball or whatever. So what was your experience like going into sports that you were less familiar with than lacrosse, hockey, baseball?
Yeah, I think watching others coach, right, and in the context of knowing what you know, is important. And I think it's kind of like parenting. You
right.
watch a lot of other people parent. And the guiding light of parenting, in my opinion, is watching what people do really well and how kids respond. And then ultimately watching what some people don't do very well and how do kids respond. And then modeling your behavior around trying to find a way to, you know, be a parent in the process and stewarding your kids through childhood. And ultimately, I don't know if I did it right. I think, you know, I have kids that are 27 and 25 right now that I think are pretty well adjusted, but I'm sure that they would kind of guide me in, retroactive history and sharing. Maybe I wasn't as good as I think I was. But I think, you know, it's an excellent question. I mean, I coached basketball when the kids were little. I tried to stay in what I knew well, in lacrosse, and I had some background in hockey. You know, growing up in the era that I grew up in, you played a ton of sports, right?
Right.
You put the lacrosse stick down and you picked up the hockey stick and you played, I played rugby. I played every sport. So I think coaching is sport agnostic. It's connecting with players and connecting with the athletes, connecting with the parents, connecting with other coaches. It's team dynamic and culture and, you know, all the things that are buzzwords today. But ultimately, it's about trying to get the best out of a kid. And I always said, as the kids that I coached were growing up, I always thought to myself, I'm not coaching, and yes, I like to win. We all do, right? And losing sucks and all that type of stuff. I wanted to teach them. But this was really about turning young athletes into great adults, into what they may not play lacrosse anymore, right? But the measure of what I was doing was about teaching them teamwork and teaching them, you know, how to be leaders and teaching them how to, you know, establish themselves and be confident and, you know, all those things. So I think that's sport agnostic activity. I mean, it's, yes, winning and losing and skills and all that type of stuff is important, but it's more about determination and heart and stick to it, a perseverance and all the things that really become the hallmark of great young adults and then future parents. So, you know, I think you have to think that way, but it's tough when you're putting your six-year-old into soccer, right? To think about them as an adult and, right, and how they persevere. But, you know, then and talk about the first book, but the next book is Sideline Ready, right? Sideline Ready is for parents.
Yeah.
I signed my kid up for a sport. Now what? I don't, you know, I've never been a parent. And, you know, there's a journey there of trying to figure out how do you have conversations as a coach about hard things for kids to understand, playing time, fairness, not fairness, right? Competition, you know, and how do you beat some of those things? So look, man, it's a great question. Other sports. I just think this is very sport agnostic. This is about trying to come up with an understanding of who, you know, the pathway that you want to take these young athletes through. And, you know, I'm also very, very fortunate to have a teacher as a wife, or a wife as a teacher. And she guides me has guided me through this process of how to speak to kids and how to kind of steward them through a process. And she's been a great guide to help that. Because teachers teach a lot of stuff, right, Terry?
Yeah, no doubt.
They teach all the subjects, especially in fifth grade where she's at, or elementary school. They teach all the subjects. So it's not like lacrosse or basketball or football, right? That's not important. It's how do you teach the child?
Yeah. And I, you know, that was coded into your wife who's a teacher who's a wife flip there. But so I do want to get into some of the more particulars, but I have two more questions just about like kind of the overall message and tone of the book. So message, my interpretation is that what you want, the overriding feeling or takeaway for everyone who reads the book, for whom the book is intended, so somebody who comes in with a mindset of being overwhelmed or feeling like they don't know as much as they should, is it is okay to be overwhelmed. It is not okay to be overwhelmed because you think you do not know enough, because not knowing enough is inherent in the exercise that you are partaking. So don't be overwhelmed because you don't know enough. Just give yourself permission to learn. Is that the right interpretation of the message that you're trying to send?
Yeah, 100%. I also believe that you know, there are many coaches at many levels, right? And a lot of us coaches, dad coaches, mom coaches, age out as our kids get older. And then there's a lot of these coaches that stick around, and some of them shouldn't. Honestly, like, they get too tired and old and stuck in their ways, or coaching with philosophies that are 20 years old as opposed to evolving, you know, in this process. So ultimately, as you enter the new, like, enjoy the ride. Enjoy, you know, there's a part in the book about rainbows. And I think this is super important. They're kids. Let them be kids, right? If there's a rainbow or a helicopter or whatever, just stop practice and let them look at it, right? Don't be so myopic that you're looking at these kids going, hey, focus on your job. Well, it's not a job. They're kids. They're having fun. It's supposed to be fun.
Right.
And I think people get overwhelmed by emails and text messages and technology and schedules and you know, referee, all this stuff. It's supposed to be fun. I got to tell you, that's retrospective for me, because sometimes I didn't have fun in the whole thing.
Right.
You know, and I think some people need that reassurance that it's sports. We're not curing cancer for, you know, there's a lot of people doing a lot of really good work. This is good work, but it's supposed to be fun.
Yeah. The point that you made about text messages and emails is a really nice segue into the last kind of overarching question that I have, which is about the tone and the style in which this is written, because it's very short, choppy sentences, a lot of subheads with small sections underneath separated by lines. And in that way, it's very much written in a modern text-based format, something that you would very much encounter online. But by the same token, it felt to me, knowing you for more than a decade at this point, like it was written the way that you would want to read it, meaning that, like, you know, just the level of directness that you try to communicate, you know, a note or a thought in 8 words. And I was like, all right, yeah, that's Steve Govett's style coming through. Can you speak to effectively how you started your pursuit of wanting to do this, knowing that you wanted to make it accessible for a certain type of person? And in order to do that, you needed to communicate it in a particular type of way.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think I woke up one day and said, you know what? I've been thinking about this. I've been taught there's other books in my head that won't be written this particular way, that are much more kind of prose driven, right? And story driven. But this was, I needed to make this in a matter of fact type of way. So my head kind of went towards, you know, just be simple, be direct, and get the job done. And it's not long, it's super easy read. I think, you know, a lot of people that I've shared this with to get their feedback have read it, you know, in an hour.
Yep.
Right. It's
about how
long
it took
read.
Me.
And when you walk away from it, I hope that people have a perspective that this is not, I hope more people decide to coach because they've read this, rather than, okay, I did sign up, now what do I do type of thing. Like, I just hope people look at this who are thinking about, okay, I've got a four-year-old and he's not ready or she's not ready to be coached today, but I really would like to try this. And maybe they get a chance to look at it and say, you know what, this is an opportunity that I can jump into in the future. But yeah, it was really in my head kind of, I've got all this knowledge of this environment, this coaching process. And I don't think I've seen anything else out there like this. So if I did more research when I wrote it, maybe I would have known there was. But at the end of the day, I think it had a place.
Diving into a few more specifics, one of the things that really stood out to me was chapter 4, the header of which is Parents, Messages, and the Myth of Quick Texts. And the subhead is Why Communication Becomes Exhausting and How Structure Changes Everything. Can you speak to the myth of the, quote, quick text? I think we've all received this message. Hey, just have a quick text for you. And then what do you mean when you say structure?
Yeah, I think the quick text is practice at four, right? And all of a sudden that gets missed by half the people that you sent it to, right? And it's, there's so many different ways to communicate now, right? And you need to establish, this is the simple truth. This is the core messaging platform. And it sounds silly, but if you're going to use Slack, use Slack. But don't send one message to one person one way and one message to somebody else the other way. And I just think that's, you know, the quick text that doesn't have context around it, you know, can create this, you know, because you're running fast and you send half thought, right? All of a sudden, someone else is receiving it in the context of their experience, and they think something different than you do. So I think you got to sit down, make sure that you're, you know, you're in the right mind, everybody's on the same page, and you're using a, you know, a very clear, simple messaging process. And it's established long beforehand so that you're just meeting people, A, where they are and their expectations.
And I think that's what the early part of the book is really successful at making clear, which is the job of being a coach is predominantly to be the communicator and the decision maker, and understanding the burden of everybody looking to you both to do those things. And that is why, like, create, one of the terms that comes later in the book is creativity is more important, or I'm sorry, confidence is more important than creativity. Doubling back onto what, you know, I think you and I would agree, and I'm coming at this from the standpoint of, you know, watching my family members coach, watching my friends coach, watching my coworkers coach. And I really do think the default assumption is, do I have enough subject matter expertise in order to do this? When the reality is, do I understand what I'm getting myself into, which is I need to be the clear and effective communicator, and I need to be the person who has the confidence to make the decision that everybody else is going to follow behind. And that's why the notion of confidence being more important than creativity struck a chord with me, because, you know, we hear this with officials all the time. Like, it's better to make the wrong decision sternly than to make the right decision but seem as if you're waffling, because the message that you're communicating creates, or the tone with which you're communicating creates this opportunity for the aggrieved party to pick at that uncertainty and say, you don't even know if you think you're right, right? And so avoid that by virtue of being confident. How does that manifest in, you know, being the coach of a team full of 6-year-olds whose primary responsibility is communicating with a bunch of 30 and 40-somethings who are busy?
Well, and that's some part of the core of the book is this is a two-lane pathway, right? The you're coaching 6-year-olds, you're coaching 8-year-olds on the field and on the floor and in the coaching environment on the field of play, and then you're also literally the CEO of a small organization.
That was where I wanted to go next. I loved that.
And everybody is looking at you to be this authority. And I think it's okay to kind of put your hand up and say, okay, I don't know, and I'm going to get help with the on-field construction process, right? I'm going to find that coach. And I know that you probably want to talk about how to pick assistant coaches.
Yes.
Right? At some point. But this whole concept of being that CEO of this little world really requires you to, again, you don't have to be a massive leader to do this, but you do need to make sure that you're communicating and you're direct and you're making decisions in a way that, you know, thinking about and being conscious of protecting the group, you know, and what's good for the group, and what's most important for the team, which is, you know, again, a pattern that you want to model for the kids on the field. But there's also a very fine line, Terry, and it's one of those, you want to be confident, but arrogant and ignorant, right, are two very dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, and so if you're over confident about certain things, you know, it's kind of know what you know type of thing. I used to work on a press, right, in a printing press. And there was this point in time where you clean the printing press. They slow it down. You have to clean the printing press. And I was terrified that my hands were going to go through this printing press because you're very close to these rollers and terrified. And I used to say that to the head pressman, like, man, this is scary. Like I'm sticking my hand very close to the, you know, to the fire, if you will. And he said, good, you should be afraid of that. The more you're afraid, the more you pay attention. And so that's a guiding thought process here is the more you're afraid you're going to screw up, the more you're paying attention to it. So experience builds the confidence, but be persistent and continue to be wary of those pitfalls in the process. And I will guarantee you that every coach that signs up to coach, you get out of left field, pardon the pun, some of the most bizarre, odd, you know, weird situations that you're supposed to be a leader in. You know, if you coach in lacrosse in Denver and you go way out to Dick's Sporting Goods Park, you may be dealing with a tornado watch.
Right.
And you didn't sign up for that. Right. But now all of a sudden you're the guy that's dealing with the tornado watch, right? Or the kids at the tournament that go, you know, play in the stream and fall and, you know, and now all of a sudden, you know, they're soaking wet and their gear's all dirty and they got to now I'm a laundry guy.
Right.
You know, so there's just so many things that kind of come up and you just got to take it in stride and deal with it or delegate it. Right.
And that you brought up assistant coaches, and that's where I want to go next, because you identified three different types of roles: the technical coach, the helper, and the motivator. And the part that I gravitated toward in that section were the risks associated with each. And so, for instance, the motivator, you isolated one of the risks being confusing positivity for accountability, which I thought was like a really interesting reflection of, you know, the combination of, I suppose, the challenge of this, right? When you're talking about different levels of what you're trying to do competitively here, right? Like, you know, 6-year-olds, the level to which they need to be held accountable is different from, you know, 12 or 13-year-olds. And that's an important one. And then with respect to that, to the helper, the risk that you isolated was inadvertently getting in the way, which I thought was also really interesting. And so far as, you know, how you try to help somebody know, like, hey, we really appreciate what you're doing, but at the same time, like, this is what I need you to avoid getting in the way of. So do you mind just going a little deeper on what you're trying to communicate with those two points in specific?
Yeah, I think selecting, sometimes you're not selecting assistant coaches. They just step up and you need help and you say yes, right? But determining quickly what their expertise is and which lane they're going to fulfill for you so that you can understand that that capacity is taken care of. And I had a blessing to work, you know, for a long time with coaches. We had 4 Division I lacrosse players all coaching one team in Colorado, in Denver, right? And that's like unheard of.
Right.
That you would have all the dads that all played Division I lacrosse in their day, but each and every one of those dads, while having a different kind of expertise level of coaching or playing, or you know, they all brought something different to the table, and I think that guided my thought process. And having watched my kids play other sports that I wasn't involved in coaching, there was an expertise level of a particular coach. And then, you know, you had the helper, the guy that was just patting people on the back, or he was putting the wet towel on their backs when it's 100 degrees outside. And so you just have to embrace, you know, the diversity of the coaches that are coming to the table. But as the head coach in this process, you better figure out what they do and make sure that they're aligned with what you're trying to accomplish. And if they're not, then you have to communicate quickly. And, you know, you have to make sure, and that's sometimes really hard. We're talking about volunteers. You don't want to hurt somebody's feelings in the process.
Right.
And somebody, if somebody oversteps, you know, you're not, you know, we're not talking about the National Lacrosse League where you're firing coaches and, you know, the NBA where, you know, they have one coach for every player. You know, it's like you need to take what you get in some of these cases, and God bless these people that step up, that want to be a part of it. The team parent that wants to deal with scheduling fields because you don't want to, right? So you have to, like I said, you have to be a CEO and you have to be able to delegate, but sometimes there's nobody with the expertise that you need. And so you better develop that quickly. But again, it's a volunteer environment, right? It's like, okay, somebody's got expertise. I'm going to embrace that quickly and then give it to them and let them do it. But yeah, like picking assistant coaches is difficult. I think having people step up, and the other thing is, like, what if six people step up, right? You better figure out a lane for them to live in and then define it. But yeah, once again, supposed to be fun, right? It's supposed to be, at the end of the day, this is kids' sports.
So that is a really nice platform to open up the conversation, because I don't want to like move on from the book. I just want to open it up, because a lot of the second half of the book is about communicating with the different challenges or problems that arise. And I think that is a really compelling lens through which to look at the broader conversation about what's wrong with youth sports, because I think the conversation to this point has been really reflective of what's right about youth sports. And I think that was one of the things I appreciated about the tone so much, is that especially as the narrative has developed over the last 20 years, that has accelerated over the last five, that private equity is entering club sports and club sports are doing such a good job of pulling talent away from rec sports, and it's killing rec sports, and sport specialization is killing multi-sport participation and overall sport participation as a result, while we're dealing with all these like incoming threats, such as, you know, increasingly compelling video game options that are competing for kids' time and attention. It strikes me that the tone that you took to this is a pretty good one to have the conversation about the problem of privatization, the problem of high-end competition and, you know, elite development, and the way that that collides with the real virtues of what folks are trying to get out of this. I have a allergic reaction to the romanticism for a world gone by that's never coming back. And I think that, you know, for somebody that's my age and certainly somebody that's your age, it is such an easy trap to fall into. And I'm going to throw him under the bus because he deserves it. But Quint Kestnick falls into this trap all the time. He wants everybody to have the experience that he had as a child of the late 70s and early 80s. And what I tell him is, like, it just is not available, right? Whether it's governmental spending or how parents try to position their kids. And oh, by the way, Quint, like, your daughter's life is a really good reflection of the way in which the world has evolved that way. Long question, bit rambly, so I apologize. Don't have a actual like pinpoint specific question, so let me just default to the crutch that I usually do, which is react to everything I just said.
Yeah. Okay, so now we're kind of outside the book, but I will say
we are, with the exception of the fact that the book does touch on how do you deal with parents who want more playing time for their kids? How do you deal with parents who, you know, want a more competitive experience than the team setting is prepared to offer for their kids? So it's like I said, yeah, it's kind of like the graduation away from the end of the book.
I think the way I've kind of thought through this book was that this is people entering the portal.
Yep.
Right. And entering the funnel. And there's a wide-eyed experience of, you know, I want my kids to play sports. And there's a section where I talk about kind of differing skill levels and how do you coach differing skill levels, right? And how do you understand? And so I'll get to the concept reaction of what you're talking about. But when you enter the portal, some kids may have been in clinic. Some kids may have, you know, kind of experienced this somewhere else and they join a team and all of a sudden their skill level is faster and higher and better, or maybe they're bigger, right? Because kids, you know, grow and develop at different stages. It's like, how do you know that that coach that gets that bigger kid is spending more time with that kid than he is with the kid, let's say, quote unquote, at the end of the bench. And I mean, Malcolm Gladwell did an amazing kind of dissection of this in Outliers in the first chapter, when it talks about Canadian hockey players, because we talk about age-based versus, calendar-based athletes compared to school calendar-based athletes, yep. Right? And the age level of where they're at. And so those hockey players that were born in January, February, March got more attention because they were bigger as kids, and they ultimately developed faster. And there are more players in the National Hockey League, right, were born in January, February, March than there were later in the year. Conversely, in other sports that are more U.S.-based and more school-based calendar, you see more players that are born September, October, November. But it's neither here nor there, but that's part of the indicative issue that you're talking about is I do think these are phased processes and stages, right? I think there is a place for, obviously, there's a place for player development at the highest level. And there's a lot of people that are commercializing that and monetizing that, and they're doing a wonderful job. The challenge, I think, today with sports, youth sports especially, is this challenge of, what if my kid's not that guy or that girl, right? Do they get to still play? And where do they get to play? And how do they get to play? Because the whole, you know, backyard lacrosse or backyard baseball or whatever it is doesn't necessarily exist. The sandlot doesn't exist the way the romantic sandlot doesn't exist the way that we think it does. The reaction I have is twofold. One, what do we do about attracting more people, more players to sport, right? And then specifically, we're lacrosse-centric, right? And I think we have flaws in the funnel. And people want to talk about how to grow the game, which I think is this, you know, ridiculous statement of, well, grow the game. Well, you can't grow the game if all you're doing is getting more kids to play at the elite level in your club system, and you just took them from another club, right? The pie is not getting larger. And so what I'm afraid of, and what USA Lacrosse and Mark Riccio and I talk about constantly, Canadian lacrosse, what are we doing about the funnel, about the entry-level funnel? And that's where I think not enough time is being spent by lacrosse, you know, executives to understand the funnel. And that funnel has a lot of different entry points. You can come in as a consumer of tickets, of merch, of collectibles, of playing, right? And all those pro teams that are spending a ton of money at the grassroots level trying to get more kids into the concept of putting a stick in their hand, that's a really long-term tale to consumerism, to make sure that they're buying tickets 20 years from now. Look at MLS. MLS spent a lot of time, energy, and money in the 90s trying to get kids to play soccer and the soccer moms to buy tickets. MLS is where they are today because 30 years ago, they invested a ton of money from a grassroots perspective. And now all of a sudden, all those kids have grown into 40-year-olds with kids of their own that are consumers, right? And so I believe the challenge is we have not clearly defined what the funnel should be and what attracts them to the funnel, whether it's at the pro level. And by the way, I think the PLL does an amazing job at meeting kids where they are online, on social, right? And providing kind of really base level fun content for them to consume, whether it's, you know, games or you know, the broadcasters and the way they talk to people. So the PLL, I think, is meeting people at a lot of different levels and doing a wonderful job of it. Maybe some of the other pro leagues need to take, you know, stock in what they're doing, because you can't just put on a game and hope people consume it. I think you have to have a strategy at the very base level for, again, the national governing bodies or the international federations like World Lacrosse is to understand, how do we enter people into the funnel? And if you don't have coaches, you don't have officials, and you don't have engaged parents that want to be part of that infrastructure, kids aren't going to play.
So
that's a lot. React to that.
Yeah. Well, no, I refuse to react to that. I agree with pretty much everything that you said, but I want to finish the conversation with this, because I have a very particular point of view on how somebody who has never picked up a stick, an expression that you and I both have a certain measure of disdain for, should experience picking up a stick for the first time. And while this is a general conversation about coaching, because that's what your book is about, it is a lacrosse podcast, and you and I look at the world through a lacrosse lens first. So if we accomplish the goal of getting people to listen to this and then subsequently read the book who have never coached lacrosse before, I would like them to leave this conversation having heard my point of view on how I see lacrosse being coached to beginners too frequently, and what I think the fundamental flaws of it are, and why I think those are flawed, and how I think it should be taught. And then I would like for you to react to that. So, lacrosse is uniquely poorly positioned to learn how to play when you're young. Because a lot of other sports, either the ball is on the ground, right? That's soccer's biggest advantage, is that the ball is always on the ground, so it can't fall. Or kids learn how to manipulate the thing with their hands, which is inherently easier to do than learning how to manipulate a thing with a tool, which is what a lacrosse stick is. And so with that basis, I say that learning how to catch a lacrosse ball in a lacrosse stick is the third hardest thing we ask kids to do when they play sports. The hardest thing is to hit a thrown ball with a bat. That's why we have T-ball. The second hardest
round
thing...
Round ball, round bat. Yeah.
Correct. The second hardest thing, if that was a subtle endorsement of cricket, then your Canadian-ness is showing. the second hardest thing is ask kids to skate. Right. And so that's why, like, pretty much every hockey system, in my understanding of things, like, you know, you kind of, the expectation is that you know how to skate when you show up. So you kind of divorce. Now you learn how to skate in a hockey player's way, but like the expectation is that you've been out on the ice on skates before and you know how to move around a little bit. And so the point is that lacrosse has this disadvantage where we have, you know, these kids with very raw and developing motor skills. We ask them to manipulate this tool in order to keep a heavy, scary ball in the air and throw it at each other. And so so that is why one of the first things that coaches do when they get a bunch of beginning lacrosse players is have them play catch. And I think that is a fool's errand. I think that the skills should be taught in this sequence. Learn how to pick the ball up off the ground first, because it is going to be the thing that you do the most when you are learning how to play lacrosse. The second thing is learn how to run with the ball in your stick without it falling out. The third thing is learn how to throw it, and the best way to do that is to something that doesn't need to catch it. And we're fortunate that we have this thing called the goal that everybody likes throwing the ball into. So throw the ball into the goal. And then the fourth thing is learn how to catch it. And my thing is that if you're going to do a four-day camp, then you probably, I would say, you shouldn't expect a kid who's never played lacrosse before to try to catch a lacrosse ball before day four. have day one be basically a bunch of different versions of Hungry Hungry Hippos. Because that's one of the things that's so advantageous about this, is that the things that you can do in order to get better at picking the ball up off the ground or running without having it fall out of your stick are things that kids love to do. Like play Hungry Hungry Hippos or do basically a egg and spoon relay race, right? Those are basically your first 2 days. And then again, the third day is just shooting. Throw the ball into the net. Kids love doing that. And then by the fourth day, hopefully the elements of the first three skill sets are a little bit more better established, and especially when it comes to the fine motor movement of being afraid of the ball and then also potentially knowing how to manipulate the stick such that you can catch it has developed enough that now all of a sudden there's a little bit more fertile ground than there is if that's the first thing that you do. So again, your thoughts.
Wow, that's a lot.
I know, right? That's what you come to the Inside Lacrosse podcast for, bro.
I mean, I don't disagree with anything that you've said. Obviously, I mean, I think every clinic I've ever started starts with, especially with little kids, is starting with this process of explaining what a stick is, right? And the stick, we always talk about the stick, which has this really intrinsic value to the game and is very important and personal to everybody. But for the first kid to pick up a stick and play, you know, it's really difficult. So I explain it, the stick has a head. Right. And the stick has a body, as you know, that's the shaft. And everybody laughs when you tell them that the bottom of the stick's called a butt end. And everybody, you know, ha ha ha. Right. And so making them laugh and making them have fun with that and understanding that is important. But what does every good head have? Right. It's got ears and a nose and all, you know, it's got, we always talk about stick has eyes, but yep, it does. We'll talk about that. You know, you talk about that later. But every good head has a mouth. Right. And so the mouth of your stick, you got to keep it open to the ball. If the ball's food and you, right, it's the Pac-Man kind of, that's the really, the very basic, simplest form of, you got to pick up the ball. And that I spend so much time early on with coaching specifically, the book doesn't talk about any of this because we don't talk specifically about lacrosse, but you know, it's about picking the ball up. Because it's going to end up on the ground, right? And some big monster kid's going to come along and check it out of you. So it's on the ground again. You got to pick it up. But yeah, I mean, why do you think sharks and minnows is the most popular game played at every, you know, camp, clinic, you know, and relay races and all those things? But at the end of the day, it's you got to pick the ball up. You got to keep it in your stick. And you're right. You want to throw it in a goal. So those three things are the very basic elements of the game of lacrosse. But, you know, we collectively as a sport, you want to get more people playing the game, and the exposure to that, you know, it's a big leap to go from, I tried it once at a, you know, in my PE class, to, yep, I'm going to play the game and engage in the game and I'm going to sign up for a league. And at some point in time, somebody's got to figure out how that transition happens, how you connect the tipping point to understand that I put a basketball in a kid's hands. There's a pretty simple, right? Every two-year-old gets the basketball hoop at Christmas and knows what to do, right? And every... there's a reason why every parent puts their kid in soccer first, right? Because you put a ball on the ground and it doesn't move unless you kick it. You can't use your hands, really simple. And so the next transition leap is I keep kicking it and I keep kicking it onto a field with a team. And inherently, soccer is always the entry point into sports. I mean, name another sport that you enter the sports portal as a three or four-year-old kid, if you're putting your kids in sports and you're very sports-oriented. Soccer is the entryway for every sport.
No doubt.
I mean, it might be gymnastics because you can do a somersault or sure, something like, you know, that type of thing. But honestly, I think boys and girls, they play soccer. It's not lacrosse. And so we have a fundamental disconnect in the introduction of the sport. And I think it comes back to, you know, where we lack entryway into the portal into the game is, and going back to the book, is mom and dad coaches. There's just not enough people that are stepping up, putting their hand up and saying, I'll do this even though I never played. And, you know, if you're sports oriented, usually you have a pathway and then you go recruit kids to come and play on your team, right? Because that's how I did it. I wanted my two kids to play. So I went and recruited 14 other kids to play the game.
Yep.
And I honestly couldn't tell you if all those 14 other kids are still playing. I know one of mine is. And, you know, my daughter is a significant consumer of the game, right? So she is still actively involved in sports in a much different way than the player. So it just goes to show, and I think, you know, the people that listen to this podcast or talk more about, you know, lacrosse, we need people at every level of the game consuming and engaging in the sport, whether it's as a continued player, right? As a ticket buyer to go to games, as a consumer on television, as a merchandise buyer, as like, these are all very important portals for the game of lacrosse. And we don't talk, all we talk about ever is picking up a stick and playing. That's not the only way to consume. How many people actually played football that go to the National Football League game? Half the women, like 50% of the consumers for the NFL didn't play football in an organized format. Might have played touch or tag or whatever. But you want to grow these sports to proliferate them, like lacrosse, we need to have multiple entry points into our game. TFL is trying to address that with some collectibles that we've never had in lacrosse before. Really, PLL is doing a good job of it. You know, TFL is addressing that by trying to create entry-level portals for kids to consume. Anyway, that's a bit of a tagline for TFL. So.
Well, it's also a good note to end on. The book is called Whistle Ready. The author is Steve Govett. Where do they find it?
You can go to tflsport.com, not sports, sport, tflsport.com. It's going to be available on the website, and it's $11.98. Why? I don't know. It's an ebook form. I'm not printing copies. I'm not doing this to get rich. This is just a passion project for me. But if people want to get the book, I think there's an opportunity, and I'm happy to, you know, chat with any potential new coach and give them a couple pointers if they choose to reach out. So I'd love to hear from them. But tflsport.com to find Whistle Ready. The next one is Sideline Ready for a bunch of parents. And then we might do Whistle Ready again for a bunch of new referees.
There you go.
I just think there's a whole bunch of platforms here and application here. But Terry, thanks for having me. It's been fun. I really appreciate talking about this. Like I said, it's a passion project and it's been fun.
Steve, you're the man. We'll talk soon.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.